Spirit Blade Underground, episode 466. Warning, access restricted. Please submit to DNA verification. Processing. Verification complete. Access granted. Welcome. Audio file encryption processing. Transmission decoded. Begin playback for system file. Spirit Blade Underground, episode 466.
Hello and welcome to the Monitor Room at the Spirit Blade Underground podcast, a biblical examination and celebration of geekery and geek entertainment, as well as the official podcast of Christian Geek Central, a website and community you can check out at ChristianGeekCentral.com. I'm Peter Franson from Spirit Blade Productions, producing entertainment and resources to hopefully equip, encourage, and inspire Christian geeks like you and me to live more and more for Christ. For more info and free goodies, check out SpiritBlade.com. On the show today, holy cow, so much stuff. Stuff from last week, stuff from this week, super packed show, reviews for Spider-Man Homecoming and War for the Planet of the Apes, plus some free superhero movies and TV shows, a review of the Star Wars audiobook Dynasty of Evil, a spotlight on the Sonic the Hedgehog comics, and a spotlight on Christian geek novels and games. So much stuff. I've been looking forward to getting back and just kind of talking with you guys about. There's some stuff that came up that came to mind on my vacation, geeky stuff that I would love to talk about, but it's gonna have to wait till next week because there's just so much. This show, I haven't done a count yet, but this, I don't know if this is gonna be the biggest pod, longest podcast, but it's gonna be among the bigger ones, I suspect. So we gotta get right to it. All right, this is audio journal number 5 since the incident. I'm still pretty sure I've developed some kind of superpowers despite the negative results in the last 4 tests. I'm going to give it another try today after a trip to the hardware store. This is invulnerability test number 1. Healing factor. This is healing factor test number 1. At the very beginning of Spider-Man Homecoming, when they started putting the logo up there, they played the theme to the old TV show, like cartoon, Spider-Man, with an orchestra trying to make it sound cinematic, and I was like, oh no. Is that really what they're going to use as, like, the Spider-Man hero theme whenever he appears to do heroic things in this movie? Please, no. Please, no. I thought it was getting off to a really bad start. But that was the last thing in this movie that really, like, made me cringe at all or, like, be concerned about the quality of my experience watching it. I really enjoyed this movie. Now, if you are familiar with my reviews of past Marvel movies, I apologize. I'm going to talk about how I don't typically like them, but that's only to give a frame of reference to those who are not familiar with my with my taste regarding the Marvel movies. I don't tend to find them funny, and I think I've figured out why. I think because the jokes that come out of the characters' mouths, the witty banter and stuff, I feel like you could swap it between any of the characters and it wouldn't make a difference. It's just like, oh, here's a good little bit of, you know, witticism that we're going to have a character just say as a throwaway jokey line in the middle of combat. Who got the last joke? He got it? Okay, we'll give this line to this other person. You know, so in other words, these punchlines could be swapped around. They don't say much, if anything at all, about that particular character. They are not born out of who that character is. And I think that in recent Marvel movies, they especially like the team up ones, they haven't given the time that I would like for the characters to breathe, for us to get to know who they are, what motivates them, what they care about. And that mistake was not made, I didn't feel, in this movie. I felt like the characters were given the chances they needed to breathe as they were being introduced. so that when they said something funny or something funny happened, there's something, you know, it all grew out of who they individually were. So let me talk a little bit just about what this movie felt like to me, the plot, the script, just the tone in general. It's not an origin story. There's a little opening where Peter is taking us through these webcam journals things that he made, these vlogs of like his experience with Civil War and how that came about, what led up to it. And so it was a neat little recap of his involvement in the movie Captain America Civil War. And then we really don't get into the death of Uncle Ben. It seems like that's something that probably happened because he's living alone with Aunt May, and he mentions that like something bad happened to her recently, you know. But there's not like a weight on Peter. And this was interesting to me. Of all this is like the third attempt at like a Spider-Man franchise, and it's the first time where I felt like he has not yet learned the lesson of Uncle Ben. In other words, the whole idea of power and with great power comes great responsibility. He learns that lesson in the last two movie franchises, and I think we would say classically in the comics, because of his role in Uncle Ben's death. You know, if you don't remember, his Uncle Ben was killed by a criminal that Spider-Man could have stopped when he saw him earlier that day, but because of his own pride, he chose not to intervene and allowed that criminal to get away. And so that criminal later on, even though Peter couldn't have known this would happen, ended up killing his Uncle Ben in a mugging. And so that from the very beginning was part of that was before Peter. Well, it was just after he properly became Spider-Man, before really he was fighting crime, though, and it's what led to his main motivation of going out and, like, doing the right thing, because with great power comes great responsibility. Well, here, I mean, you could argue that maybe he's learned that lesson, but it doesn't seem like it's stuck very well, because he really just seems to be about having fun. And even though, you know, that's a different take on the character, he's not weighed down by that responsibility of what came of Uncle Ben's death, it's still fun. It's still, I think, a valid take on Spider-Man. If they eventually get around to telling us the Uncle Ben story in flashbacks, I'll have trouble maybe reconciling it, you know, if he really goes through this weighty experience, why he would suddenly be all light and carefree and irresponsible and stuff in this movie. Anyway, irresponsible. I guess it's all a matter of degrees and, you know. But anyway, there's no origin story. The stakes are pretty small scale compared to lots of big Marvel movies, and I think that's the right decision here. You make him, as Iron Man says, a friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. And it allows us to get into the characters more, but don't mistake that as a sign that like the hero is not going to be tested. He's not going to be pushed to his absolute limits, you know. In fact, they borrow some visuals and a little beat from a famous Spider-Man comic in which he is absolutely pushed to his limits to lift something off of his back. And so they really do allow still for drama and pushing this character to his absolute physical and emotional limits. Dang it, I've got something in my eye. There's like these are uncut reviews. I can't stop. I can't stop. The humor is also very character-driven. I really appreciated that. Still lots of big action, even with the smaller stakes. When I say smaller stakes, it's really more about who will be affected if the hero fails to stop the villain. And compared to what we've seen in recent Marvel movies, the stakes are pretty small in terms of who will be affected. I suppose you could argue potentially in the long term, many, 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 many people would be affected. But in the immediate future, if he doesn't stop the villain, the stakes are, you know, relatively small compared to other Marvel movies. But the action is still very big and, you know, and spectacular. And there's a great twist connecting the plot, two major plot threads, kind of the more personal plot thread going on in Peter Parker's life with, you know, the big action, got to stop the villain plot, you know. So there was a nice twist that I didn't expect toward the last third or last fourth of the movie that it was wonderful. It was wonderful. I really enjoyed it. And I think it brought home the big gotta stop the bad guy story to that more personal level that I appreciated. So let's talk a little bit just about the cast. Tom Holland is up first, and I don't know him from anything apart from being Spider-Man, but I really enjoyed him in this, and I think he's been doing a fine job. I don't have a favorite yet. Of all the Spider-Mans, I don't have a favorite yet. Marissa Tomei played his Aunt May, and she does a great job of kind of like, it seems like they're maybe drawing from the Ultimate Marvel Universe version of Aunt May, not in terms of how she's written, but just in terms of like who she is. The Ultimate Marvel Universe Aunt May was a little more hip, she was more modern, she had more modern haircut, she wasn't this kind of like health constantly failing old woman, you know, that was, you know, a shut-in at home, you know. And Marissa Tomei's version is even younger than who was the gal that did Aunt May in the last movie. She's like, we like her, we really like her, whatever her name is, I can't remember. She's a famous actress. Anyway, so that already struck me as young because she hardly had any gray hair. And they go even younger with Marissa Tomei, and they even treat her as like someone that like everyone locally is attracted to. All the people, all like the adults in Peter's life, not all of them, but like a good chunk of them, you know, are asking about his Aunt May and how she's doing and stuff, and makes him uncomfortable that they see her as like this sexual object to be pursued. Tony Stark is into her and stuff. And but I like her as this kind of like young. I don't want to say hip, but certainly more connected to Peter Parker's stage of life than that classic version of Aunt May, where she's very much off in her own world. She's just a one or two generations definitely separated from Peter and his life experiences. So, I really like this version of Aunt May. Jacob Batalon. This is also a person that I don't recognize. I don't know if you do, but he plays Peter's. I'm not sure what the ethnicity is, if he's Hawaiian or Alaskan or Asian or, I don't know, do Hawaiians and Alaskans count as I don't know my ethnicities. But anyway, I'm going to say Asian. He's his Asian buddy at school, and he's kind of like this, just, he's that fun, kind of smiling, overweight buddy who is good with like computers, and they're all really smart because they go to this smart people, you know, high school. But he's like this. I feel like he kind of, in a sense, represents us, you know, the fanboy, you know, who's just kind of along for the ride and excited to be get a taste of this crazy world of superheroes. And he just makes a great friend for Peter Parker, a great confidant. There was, you know, one thing that I appreciated about this movie is its sweetness. You know, normally I really like movies that are more serious and more heavy, but if they're going to go in a direction that is not like that, that is not serious and heavy, then endearing is like a nice, you know, alternate choice, I suppose, for me. And I found these characters, the performances by these actors, the way they were written, the things that they were dealing with in life, all very endearing. Not because, it wasn't like heavy and weighty and stuff, and so I wasn't engaged emotionally in that way, but I was engaged emotionally with their stories because they were dealing with like high school type drama and just things that seem like such a big deal in high school that really aren't that big of a deal, you know, but I can still empathize because I remember what it was like to think of these really transient things in high school as monumental things, you know. And one example would be the love interest in the story. Her name is Liz. And she is really not much of a character herself. I would compare her to the way that they treat the love interest in the Flash TV series, at least what I saw of her the first one and a half season or so, where she is not very interesting as a character herself. She's just kind of like a prize, this beautiful girl that's always smiling and always has a positive attitude and stuff like that, and is just kind of a prize for the hero to yearn for, you know, but not really interesting or much of a character that you can relate to in and of herself. And while that doesn't work for me in a TV series that is supposed to be, I feel, you know, in at least part, or at least in that subplot, pursuing a relationship, developing a relationship, I think when the story is about the relationship, then both halves of that relationship need to be interesting people. But here, Liz doesn't need to be really interesting for me because it's not about her relationship. It's about Peter wanting to pursue the beautiful girl in the midst of all the drama that he has going on in his life. So anyway, I thought that she, you know, did a fine job, you know, in that role. The thing that I think I appreciated most about both the actors and the way the characters were written is that they allowed room for subtext. They allowed room for the actors to bring things to the script that if you were just reading the script at face value, you wouldn't see there, but they add a layer of, like, uncertainty and nervousness. You can read behind their eyes what they're thinking, how they're trying to navigate awkward, you know, situations. I really enjoy a script that allows actors to perform and bring more layers than what is actually on the written page. That's that just allows me to connect. It makes the characters feel more relatable to me, and I feel like I find myself more easily investing in their story and in what they care about. All right, stunts and visuals, just very briefly. I feel like they're getting increasingly good at placing Spider-Man in real-world environments, CG Spider-Man, that is. They're doing things with the way he moves and the physics of his movements, I guess, in subtle ways. How, like, there was one moment where he was walking across a web, and then he, like, jumped and turned around, and the way he landed and, like, balanced himself right there, I was like, that feels more real. That it felt like there he was actually dealing with, like, he was actually balancing, you know, and actually making quick adjustments with his body weight. It just, these subtle things that, you know, I spend so much more time talking about them just now than you actually see them happen. But they just feel, they make the whole thing feel more real. They make Spider-Man feel far more real than he did, especially in the Tobey Maguire trilogy, where, you know, he just, yes, he moved with fluid grace, and you could argue it's all about the fluid grace of Spider-Man, and that's why he looks so, you know, really it was just CG wasn't capable of some of those finer joint and physics details. But it's getting better and better all the time, and, you know, while my eyes are still cursed to pick out CG, I'm really enjoying what I'm seeing. It's getting closer and closer to that great and majestic day when I can be completely fooled and just not be taken out of the movie ever. Let's see. Otherwise, the special effects are solid status quo. You know, I really enjoyed what was going on. There was one shot in the climax where with the main villain where I was like, whoa, I'm picking up a really bad green screen vibe going on behind him. Maybe that's just me. Maybe I was looking for it. I don't know. But anyway, yeah, I thought, I have no complaints at all about the special effects, really. Okay, so I always try to ask myself, when I'm taking in entertainment, is there anything of worthwhile spiritual, moral, or philosophical significance that might stimulate worthwhile thought or conversation as a result of taking in this entertainment, be it a book or a game or a movie or something like that? In this case, I think maybe. I don't know. It's I think I picked up on some stuff, but, you know, I'm always kind of like looking for that stuff at the same time. The two things, I guess, that I noticed, one would be not getting credit or being appreciated for the good things that you do or the things that you are capable of. Peter is very underestimated by Tony Stark. The main plot of the movie is that, you know, he just did, Spider-Man just helped out with the whole Civil War events. Now he's like, when's the next Avengers mission? And Tony kind of passes him off to his right-hand man, Happy Hogan, you know, and just says, well, Happy will be in touch, you know, and he'll let you know. And Peter's just waiting for months and months, you know, and he's not getting any kind of missions or anything, you know, exciting to do. He's just helping out with local little, like, robberies and at best, you know, and sometimes even screwing things up, you know, one guy he attacks, who wasn't even committing a crime. It was a really funny moment. He feels like he's capable of so much more, and that his capabilities are not being tested, they're not being appreciated, they're not being taken advantage of, you know. And so there's this sense of entitlement that Peter kind of develops. Like, I should be doing more, you know, I should be... And I don't think it's entirely altruistic. I think that, you know, there's a part of him that's like, I can do more, I can be more, I can be recognized for more. I mean, I think that's what's going on psychologically there. I think that would be the case with pretty much any of us, you know. We want to be recognized when we think that we're capable of more than we're being credited for. What's interesting about this is, you know, like I said, I think we can all kind of relate to that being underestimated, underappreciated. And I would say, in looking at this story, that Tony does underestimate what Peter is capable of. And he puts limitations on Peter that are probably, you know, not fair. You know, he should be more invested. We all know Tony's a narcissist, and so he's not going to be really thinking outside of himself like he should. And so, yeah, he misses the boat when it comes to evaluating what Peter is really capable of and what he can be called up to. At the same time, Peter responds to that with this kind of sense of entitlement that says, you know what, I don't care about what Tony Stark says. I'm just going to break his rules despite all the help that he's given me. I'm going to take his gifts but spurn his authority. And I'm going to do my own thing, you know. And it causes a bunch of problems that Peter has to own up to. So anyway, I think that's something that we can relate to. And I feel like the takeaway there is maybe just for us to try and remember that ultimately our worth is not from the credit we are given by other people, the appreciation we're given by our coworkers or our superiors at work, or anybody else that we're kind of in some kind of social connection with. Our worth is in the fact that the God of the universe, for some reason we can't fathom, made us, these creatures, to reflect in some way who he is, and chose to invest himself eternally, emotionally in us, chose to come down and live as one of us and live a horrible life and die a horrible death, so that we could be reconciled to him, so that justice could be satisfied, so he could still be a just God, and at the same time, so that we could be rescued out of the mess that we caused. I mean, that's love and attention and focus that doesn't make any sense for God to be giving us. And it gives us immense worth, immense significance, far more than, you know, than any significance could be added by the fact that I could tomorrow start being able to shoot webs out of my hands or wherever. Does Ultimate Spider-Man shoot webs out of his butt? I can't remember. No. They're out of his, the tops of his hands. All right. No. That's Spider-Man 2099, not Ultimate Spider-Man. Spider-Man 2099. I don't think there is a Spider-Man that shoots webs out of his butt. Anyway, the other thing that kind of struck me is that Peter, he's not wise. He's lacking wisdom. He's not able to anticipate the consequences of his actions. And I feel like that's something that we as geeks can really relate to. What tends to be true of many of us is that we are unable to anticipate the effects that our words, our tone, our interactions with others will have on them. And we end up, you know, causing offense that we didn't intend, or other kinds of problems, you know, just social problems or tension or, you know, all kinds of things that we can't anticipate. I think the right response to that is Peter's ultimate response in this, and that is a response of humility, saying, you know what, I really thought I was in the right. I really thought that I didn't have anything to worry about and that I could handle this, but you know what? I screwed up and people got hurt because of me and because of what I couldn't anticipate. And I think oftentimes what we will do instead when other people get wounded or offended or something like that by something that we did that we didn't anticipate would offend them, we tend to become stubborn and then self-justify. You know, we'll say, well, they shouldn't da-da-da-da-da, you know. They shouldn't da-da-da-da. Blame other people. Just like, as I said earlier, I think Tony can accept some blame for not evaluating Peter properly. But that does not make Peter justified in what he chose to do. I think that's what is a valuable thing to take from this movie, is humility is the right response when we realize that something we've said or done has unintentionally had a negative effect on somebody else. We just have to say, crap, okay, whether they should have taken offense or not, lesson learned, I should not use that phrase, that tone, whatever it was that I did, lesson learned, don't do that in the future. Even though we can, you know, maybe even rightly say that the whole world is the problem, not me. Okay, well, if we want to have a good relationship with the whole world, then we need to change something about ourselves. And I think that takes humility to recognize that, you know, maybe we should be flexible instead of asking the whole world to be flexible. All right, so let's see here. That's it for this one. It's rated PG-13 for I don't know, because I had trouble with my in-law's internet. I'm recording, if you couldn't tell, I'm recording on location from my vacation, staying with the in-laws out in Pennsylvania. So that's why I've got a totally different background right now. That's why the audio is probably lousy. That's why, you know, everything's different. So anyway, I apologize for throwing everything off if that was bothering you. Because there was a problem with the computer here and I couldn't find my iPhone didn't want to behave. I don't know exactly why it's rated PG-13. I would guess it's for action and language. There wasn't sexy, skimpy clothes type stuff going on. So it's probably action and language. But anyway, that's it. All right. I'm done. I want to remind you guys to check out the other members of the Christian Geek Central Network, such as the Strangers and Aliens podcast, the Theology Gaming podcast, the Untold podcast, POSTOS, Helix Reviews, and the Retro Rewind podcast. For more information about the CGC Network, visit ChristianGeekCentral.com.
Rejoice, ye penny-pinching nerds! Rejoice! For this is a season unbound by our bank accounts, unfettered by fees. A legendary age of liberty. This is the summer of free!
Continuing our celebration of the summer of free 2017, this time with a spotlight on Crackle. Over at crackle.com, you can watch a bunch of movies and TV shows for free all year round. And right now, I want to highlight some of the stuff that you can watch the month of July, at least, 2017, over at crackle.com that might scratch some of those nerdy fiction itches for you. So let's see here. The first up would be a Marvel anime Iron Man. If you've been enjoying the Marvel movies or you just like superheroes in general and you like, you know, Iron Man. This is an anime series. Now, it is done in an anime style. I've watched a little bit of this. And it does still, I think, suffer just a little bit from some of the kind of the oddly enough, the localization issues, and I'm not sure why that is, but so it still has some of that kind of anime flavor to the voice acting, despite the fact that I think it was made for English-speaking audiences first. I'm not sure about that, but anyway, the animation, as you would expect, is really solid. So anyway, and this is all 12 episodes of this. It was just one season, one and done. The series description reads, in an effort to make amends for his weapons manufacturing past, Tony Stark has dedicated himself to building the world up rather than tearing it down, traveling to Japan to build a new arc reactor that will deliver unlimited free energy to the Japanese people. Stark is challenged by the Japanese government and the media when he attempts to import the necessary nuclear priming device, and when the reactor in construction is repeatedly attacked by the mysterious Zodiac Consortium, Stark must gather his allies to take on Zodiac and its mastermind. So based on a story by Warren Ellis, a pretty respected writer. Next up would be more Iron Man. This is a movie, though. Iron Man Rise of Technovore. The description reads, billionaire Tony Stark in his Iron Man armor prevents an attack from a mysterious new foe, but innocent bystanders are killed, including his best friend, War Machine, Lieutenant Colonel James Rhodes. Holy crap! That's a bit of a spoiler. I hope that happens right at the beginning. Detained for questioning by S.H.I.E.L.D., Iron Man escapes, determined to find the mastermind behind the attack. Pursued by Black Widow and Hawkeye, Iron Man enlists the help of the ruthless vigilante, the Punisher. Holy crap, they're throwing the whole Marvel Universe in here. But can the Armored Avenger handle... Is that a thing? Is Iron Man called the Armored Avenger? Okay. Can the Armored Avenger handle what he finds when he catches the person responsible and is forced to face his deadliest weapon, a biotechnology called Technovore that could wipe out all life on the planet? So this is another one that was, as I understand it, yeah, it's made, it's a, like anime, you know, style, like it's produced overseas. So still on this same track, Marvel anime Wolverine. This is like, and especially appropriate fit, though, because this is based on, as the series description reads, based on the popular graphic novel by Frank Miller. The series begins in Japan, where Logan is challenged by Shingen Yoshida, the notorious leader of a powerful mafia clan. Now, I've not read this story arc myself, but I know that it is highly celebrated and respected by fans as just being a definitive part of Logan, Wolverine's life. And so this would be even based on it. I don't know if it's a straight-up adaptation, but if this would, you know, that this would be even based on it, made overseas and, you know, in an anime style, it just seems like super extra fitting. So anyway, that's just called Marvel Anime Wolverine. You'll find that under TV shows. These are a combination of TV shows. Let's see what we had so far. Iron Man, Marvel Anime Iron Man, that's a TV show. Iron Man Rise of the Technovore, that's a movie. Marvel Anime Wolverine, that's a TV show. And again, it's all the episodes of that, you know, one-shot season. Robotech, if you've never, like, gotten... This is kind of like an anime series from which so many others were inspired. It's guys getting into giant robots and fighting each other. I have seen very little of this
show, but it is highly respected and is, you know, an inspiration to so many anime series that followed. The series description reads, "The Earth uses advanced alien technology from a crash-landed starship to develop giant robotic machines to fight off three extraterrestrial invasions." This is a remastered version, it says, of the 1985 product. So, and this has all 85 episodes of this series are on Crackle.com. So, yeah, if you've never dipped into that before and you want to give it a shot, this would probably be a great way to do it. Let's see here. Robotech, The Shadow Chronicles. I'm just throwing this in here. This is also on Crackle, but it's a movie. And I don't really know what its connection is, how many years it... let's see, in the year 2044 AD. What's the TV series say here? Oh, 2009 AD. Oh, man. So we've got a little bit of an alternate history thing, maybe we'll call it, going on in the original series there now. So anyway, yeah, many years later, Robotech, The Shadow Chronicles, have no idea if it's good, have no idea if it's celebrated by anybody. You know, sometimes these things can take a turn south, but I don't know if that's the case with Robotech, The Shadow Chronicles. You can find out for yourself. But if you're a Robotech fan, or even just a casual, curious person, then you can check it out. Okay, if you're in a Spider-Man-y kind of mood after watching Spider-Man Homecoming, which I could say that I am, then you can watch all of Spectacular Spider-Man, this animated series, and it's got, it's listed, let's see, does it say just one season? Yeah, it says in like the little, the letterings and numberings, you know, season one, episode 24, there were actually two seasons of this show, which had a combined total of like 26 episodes, and all 26 episodes of the two seasons produced of Spectacular Spider-Man, this animated series, are available to watch for free on Crackle. So, yeah, anyway, what's next here? Oh, The Tick. Now, this one I actually bought on DVD. I still own it. And you can watch this. This was like a series that really didn't make it. They produced just like 9 episodes. And then it was done. And I think that it was, I can't remember what I was thinking at the time that it came out, if why it wasn't successful. This is, I really think, a solid show. This is not like, it's I think it's really well written. And for my taste, it's often very funny. It's just weird and bizarre. I tend to like bizarre, random humor. And this is like, every time The Tick opens his mouth, it's written so... weirdly and wonderfully, and as performed by Patrick Warburton. I mean, I can't imagine. It's a different take from the 90s Saturday morning cartoon in terms of like how the Tick acts. He's written in a very similar way, but it's performed differently in a more subtle yet still bombastic way. I mean, I can't even describe it to you. I really, really enjoy this. Every 3 years or so, I pull this series out and I watch all 9 episodes as though they're like this massively long movie. There is some degree of continuity going on between them. So, I mean, I think it can be viewed that way. And you can watch all 9 episodes of The Tick, which I would take any one of these episodes. I mean, I watched the Amazon Prime pilot for the new Tick series that's coming out, and it definitely had a different tone. I mean, that's one thing that the Tick series and its incarnations in television has had going for it, is that, you know, it's been different flavors. And all, I think, you know, flavors that work in their own way for their own purposes, but definitely different flavors. And I'm not sure, I think the pilot for the Prime TV series worked for my taste on a number of levels, but on some levels I was like, I don't know. Yeah, but this one, there's no question in my mind. I would take more. I wish there was more of this. I wish we were getting more of this on Amazon instead of a new iteration of it. But well. Anyway, if you're not familiar at all with The Tick as a superhero, I'll read the series description here. It says, a live-action series based on the adventures of Big Blue Defender, The Tick, and his sidekick, Arthur, a former accountant whose crime-fighting costume is a moth suit, which is often mistaken as a bunny suit, at least on the animated series. I can't remember if that happened on the live-action show. Anyway, destiny deemed that these two should meet, and necessity dictated that the Tick should sleep on, excuse me, not sleep on, but sleep on Arthur's fold-out sofa bed. Despite their differences, they both share a common dream to fight evil in their city known as the City. Accompanying them on their heroic exploits is Captain Liberty, a patriotic superperson whose light from her torch of righteousness sends the roaches of wrong scurrying back to their dark, filthy crevices. Also joining the crusade for justice is Batmanuel, whose Latin charm is as big as his wingspan. And, yeah. There's definitely, like, I want to say, especially in the early episodes, you know, a lot of, like, sexual innuendo and kind of stuff going on in the humor, you know, so it's not going to be something that's, like, for the whole family to sit down and watch. Anyway, that said, I really, really enjoyed this series a lot. Okay, moving on. Alien versus Predator. Now, this is probably going to be an unpopular pick. I did not enjoy the second one at all, but I really did enjoy Alien versus Predator. Maybe part of that was because at the time we hadn't had a Predator movie in so long. I really think, if nothing else, it's a solid Predator experience. If you want to see the Predator in action doing his thing, then I think this is a great movie for that. I mean, I thought both monsters were handled really well. And despite the fact, oh, it looks like they got the rated R version here. I was going to say, despite the fact that it got a PG-13 rating in theaters, that was largely because the main conflict is between aliens with two different types of green blood, you know, so that's just not going to get the same kind of rating as a movie that has humans being gored up and stuff. But yeah, it looks like they do have the R version here. Lots of cool, crazy Alien versus Predator action. Nothing much more I need to say about that. Let's see here. Deep Blue Sea. Okay, this is maybe at this point kind of a deep cut. I don't even know if this holds up. I just saw it. I was like, oh yeah, I should at least mention that. This was before they started making all these shark movies again. I mean, I feel like there's a billion of these B shark movies that are being put out now. Before that craze started happening, we had Deep Blue Sea. And the sharks are a combination of CG in some scenes and practical in other scenes. And I just remember being really surprised at how much I liked this movie and how much it was still able to scare me. I was like, we've seen Jaws, you've done all you can with sharks, you know. Evidently not. And there's also really one great shocking moment that I do not want to spoil. But it's just like not what you would expect. Shocking and at the same time hysterical. I was laughing in shock and, I mean, yeah, anyway. And it happens early on, like in the first, I want to say, 45 minutes of the movie. So anyway, if you want to just experimentally watch up to that shocking, you'll know it. If you haven't seen it, you'll know, whoa, didn't see that coming. Anyway. Those of you laughing with me know exactly what I'm talking about. Okay, Defendor. This is probably, for me personally, the big highlight of the content on Crackle right now. I love this movie. It's starring Woody Harrelson. I reviewed this when it came out in theaters a number of years ago, and based on how quickly it came to free services like Hulu and Crackle and all that kind of stuff, I don't know that it did very well. It was kind of a small movie. Maybe that's part of it. I want to say it's maybe even an independent movie. It is a small boots on the ground take of the superhero genre, and it more boots on the ground. I want to say this is, I think I can definitively say, the most realistic take on superheroes I've seen in a movie, and maybe television as well. And that's because there are no superpowers, you know, and it's kind of like one step further than Watchmen. And Watchmen, I think, tried to, you know, delve into the psychology of what would it take for a person, a normal everyday person, to put on a costume and go and fight crime and stuff. And that really went to, you know, maybe arguably some extremes of like having people with major like mental health issues and stuff. And then in the end, they did throw in, you know, what do you call him? Dr. Manhattan with, you know, who could basically do anything. So there was a supernatural, you know, aspect to that. This has none of that. I'll just read the description here, see how it describes itself here. Woody Harrelson is construction worker by day, self-made superhero by night in Defendor, a comedy that takes aim at society's infatuation with comic book mythologies. Okay, right there, I want to stop. I don't think that's the expectation you should have going into this movie. It was marketed as a dark comedy, and I don't... Maybe, I mean, I think I have kind of a dark sense of humor, but I mean, I wasn't really laughing at this movie. This was a powerful, moving drama to me about a mentally handicapped man who has just a very pure idea in his mind of good and evil, and a recognition that there is something wrong with the world, and the wrong thing should be made right. The evil people should not be allowed to get away with what they are doing. Someone needs to stop them. This isn't right. He has such a strong, passionate view of that, you could argue, well, he's just being naive or whatever, fine. I mean, we can, just accept that as part of the fiction that will allow us to explore the reality that I think inwardly we all recognize there is something wrong with the world. It does need to be made right. This should not be allowed to happen, and so we have a character who, for a believable reason, you could say, well, yeah, maybe you would do that, but I mean, only if there's something, if you're impaired in some way, would you go to the lengths that he is going to, the extremes of commitment that he is going to be fighting crime and doing things that are very dangerous and gets in way over his head, so I think that they use that aspect of his character to kind of help try to make it believable to audiences. But anyway, it's still just a beautiful story. I think that with themes that we can all relate to. I don't know if you'll be able to relate to the movie, but I think the themes we can probably all relate to. The description continues, while the city is awake, Arthur Poppington, played by Harrelson, holds traffic signs and is nearly invisible to all who pass. After hours, he assumes his secret identity, complete with homemade costume, and prowls the streets in search of his arch nemesis, Captain Industry. Along the way, he saves a young prostitute who is played by Kat Dennings, and she was like the girl sidekick in the first Thor movie. She might have been in the second one as well. I just really enjoyed her as a performer. She was just captivating to watch. So interesting, and yeah. Anyway, he saves a young prostitute from an abusive undercover cop, a move that proves his commitment to fighting for the weak, but also turns him into a real live fugitive from the law. So anyway, if you are, up for, a potentially very heavy kind of movie experience, and you're interested in a very emotionally and psychologically, at least the strongest attempt I've seen at an emotionally and psychologically realistic take on superheroes in a movie, then I can't recommend anything more to you than Defendor. All right, let's see. Just one left here. That's Nintendo Quest. This is a documentary. The description reads, an adventure-filled documentary on Nintendo that follows two gaming enthusiasts as they hit the open road in hopes of buying all the 678 official Nintendo games in 30 days. What was interesting to me about this, I kind of passed this over for a while. I've only watched the trailer so far, but I think I'm going to pop this one on, at least while I'm doing something else, playing a video game or something like that, because there's a little more to the premise. He's committing in 30 days to buying every official Nintendo game without using the internet in any way to help in his search, I would assume his communication, he's probably going to be doing lots of phone calling, lots of, hitting the pavement, and also the sense that I get from the trailer is that it's not just about this guy going around and finding these objects. It's about the people that he interacts with who have a love for the original NES console and the games that came on it, and just what a phenomenon that was, and talking about the different perspectives along the way with the people that he meets, the different perspectives that they have on what the original NES was culturally. And so I think it's being sold to me in the trailer as kind of like a way to scratch my nostalgia and just kind of scratch that geek itch, when you just want to sit down with somebody and you don't want to debate some geek topic, you just want to celebrate something that you both love together. I think that's so much more often is what brings geeks together than the kind of the debates that we can get into. And this kind of experience, I feel like it could scratch potentially that itch of sitting down and like, oh man, I just want to geek out and I just want to remember what was really cool about the original Nintendo. So anyway, that's called Nintendo Quest. And that's a movie, a documentary, an hour and a half long, also available at Crackle.com. So there was a lot of cool stuff that I was not expecting to be able to find over at Crackle.com completely for free. I hope that there's something in all the mix that you'll be able to enjoy there while helping to save money and maybe be a little bit better steward of your finances and kind of rise to what God is calling us to as we look at the nature of our possessions and the wealth that we all have, those of us that have internet connections. So anyway, that's it, guys.
Data collection complete. Activating MusicNet 1.0.
Matt McKinney recently suggested a cool idea for a YouTube video that I added my spin to and think it will be really great content, but I need your help. The video is going to have something to do with a biblical look at collecting, and I'd like pictures or video of your collections to use in the video. And don't worry, it's not going to be, you know, well, first off, don't worry about narrating or editing the video, as I'm going to be editing and then adding my own audio to the video that I receive. But you can feel free to explain, excuse me, your collection through narration, just for my benefit if you'd like, because I may not always know what I'm looking at. Secondly, don't worry, this isn't going to be like some shame on you for materialistic collecting video. It's going to be a celebration of a God-honoring form of hobby collection, in addition to a video examining the potential heart issues that can crop up in association with collecting. So any collection pics and videos I get will be shown in either a neutral or a positive light. You can send your videos and pictures to me at PAETER at spiritblade.com. At youtube.com, I'm trying to go fast so this episode doesn't go super duper long. At youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral, there's tons of stuff on the YouTube channel now. There's Extra Life highlight videos, Christian Geek Radar, and Summer of Free videos. And for the Truth Is In There videos, which is actually my adaptation of the In Search of Truth series that I do on this podcast to a video format. I've been thinking about doing something like that for a long time. I've had my reasons for hesitating to do that. I won't go into that right now, but I did finally decide, you know, I'm going to do this. I'm going to go forward with this. And so I am in the process now of trying to catch up the YouTube audience, as it were, with where we are at here on In Search of Truth on the podcast. I'll get them mostly caught up, by next week, I think they'll be mostly caught up. Not quite. They'll still be behind this podcast for a few weeks, but at some point, I think there'll probably be an off week where I don't have In Search of Truth, and then they'll be able to catch up a little bit after that. But, anyway, so, yeah, so if you're interested in kind of digesting that in a video version, which is not all that super entertaining, it's a long term, it's just going to be picture-in-picture video where my face is down in the corner, and then I am recording that as I go through my notes, and so you'll be able to see my notes as I scroll through them and more easily, you know, catch scripture references and stuff like that, you know, and so if you want to pause and write them down or whatever, so you can do that. So anyway, if you want some kind of a visual format to kind of get that in, it's kind of, the YouTube version will kind of be a combination of what it would be like to both listen to the In Search of Truth segment on the podcast while scrolling through the text version that I post on Sundays of that. That is in the process of getting caught up to on YouTube. And then also my Spider-Man Homecoming and War for the Planet of the Apes reviews should be up by the time that you hear this. So while you're there, if you want to like, share, and subscribe, that's a great way to help to grow our community at youtube.com/spiritbladevideos. And you can also get this at spiritblade.com, I think, if you go to the news section. I've got a video tour up of my new office space now that I've kind of moved into it. The video itself actually is still not quite up to date, you know, to where I'm at today, but pretty close. You can get an idea of the layout compared to my old office and the space that I have now. I'm very excited about it. There's just a lot more potential for things that I can do, and content that I can produce much more easily and stuff. So yeah, I'm very excited about this space. So you can take a look at that again at youtube.com/spiritbladevideos. Let's see here. If you want to help help support what's going on at Spirit Blade Productions, then you can do that by becoming a Spirit Blade Insider or just giving a, you know, a one-time gift. There's more information if you go to our About page at spiritblade.com. But I wanted to especially bring this to your attention right now. We've got like the funds for Spirit Blade Productions, which covers Christian Geek Central, everything that I do online is all funded by Spirit Blade Productions. So the funds for that are a little bit low right now, and it's not a scary thing, it's not a bad thing. We're going to dip into the red for just a little bit, and then I think, you know, we'll be able to get out of it, but it could potentially slow down some things that I would like to bring about on the YouTube channel. There's a board game series that I'd like to do. The Gloomhaven series was received really pretty well, and there's another board game series I'd like to do that's a little bit time sensitive, because the game that I'm going to be doing it on is kind of like among the hot topic games at BoardGameGeek.com. And so I'd like to get on that quickly, but I might be delayed a little bit because of you know, the lack of potential in funds to kind of purchase some of the equipment I need that will help that actually happen in a timely manner. So I just put that out there. If you're interested in becoming a Spirit Blade Insider, that's, you get monthly exclusive behind the scenes goodies of just kind of my adventures in the spinning a million plates, trying to keep all this afloat and moving forward and watching it as it shifts and evolves and all the ups and downs and the drama that comes along with that. And also for a number of months now, I've been putting out the Tully Files, which kind of gives you behind the scenes fly on the wall recordings of me and Michael Tully, who played Rand Galvanic in the Spirit Blade trilogy when he came out to record for Spirit Blade: World of Shadows. So that kind of like behind the scenes stuff, if that interests you, then being a Spirit Blade insider might be right up your alley. And of course, you can also support us by purchasing a download for of one of our original sci-fi or fantasy audio dramas, maybe for a friend or family member, using our available gift codes. So anyway, I put that out for you for your consideration. More information on all that at spiritblade.com.
Hi guys, this is Katja from the Netherlands, Comic Kate on the Christian Geek Central forums. Here's my fourth audiobook short, a series of very concise reviews of the audiobooks I have finished. This time I read, or rather listened to, Dynasty of Evil, the final part of the Darth Bane trilogy, a Star Wars novel from the so-called Expanded Universe. It's written by Drew Karpyshyn and narrated by Jonathan Davis. This audiobook is 9 hours and 25 minutes long, and since I forgot to mention the duration of the other two Darth Bane novels, I'll give those now. Path of Destruction is 12 hours 11 minutes, and Rule of Two takes 10 hours 12 minutes. Of course, I will start this review with the publisher's summary, which says, 20 years have passed since Darth Bane, reigning Dark Lord of the Sith, demolished the ancient order devoted to the dark side and reinvented it as a circle of two. One master to wield the power and pass on the wisdom, and one apprentice to learn, challenge, and ultimately usurp the Dark Lord in a duel to the death. But Bane's acolyte, Xana, has yet to engage her master in mortal combat and prove herself a worthy successor. Determined that the Sith dream of galactic domination will not die with him, Bane vows to learn the secret of a forgotten Dark Lord that will assure the Sith's immortality, and his own. A perfect opportunity arises when a Jedi emissary is assassinated on the troubled mining planet Doan, giving Bane an excuse to dispatch his apprentice on a fact-finding mission, while he himself sets out in secret to capture the ancient holocron of Darth Andedu and its precious knowledge. But Xana is no fool. She knows that her ruthless master has begun to doubt her, and she senses that he's hiding something crucial to her future. If she is going to claim the power she craves, she must take action now. While Bane storms the remote stronghold of a fanatical Sith cult, Xana prepares for her master's downfall by choosing an apprentice of her own, a rogue Jedi, cunning and cold-blooded enough to embrace the Sith way, and to stand beside her when she at last wrests from Bane the mantle of Dark Lord of the Sith. But Xana is not the only one with a desire and power to destroy Darth Bane. Princess Sarah of the Doan royal family is haunted by memories of the monstrous Sith soldier who murdered her father and tortured her when she was a child. Bent on retribution, she hires a merciless assassin to find her tormentor and bring him back alive to taste her wrath. Only a Sith who has taken down her own master can become Dark Lord of the Sith. So when Bane suddenly vanishes, Xana must find him, possibly even rescue him, before she can kill him. And so she pursues her quarry from the grim depths of a ravaged world on the brink of catastrophe to the barren reaches of a desert outpost, where the future of the Dark Side's most powerful disciples will be decided, once and for all, by the final fatal stroke of a lightsaber. As for my own thoughts on this novel, alas, the trilogy has ended. I actually started and finished this audiobook in only one day. That's how gripping it was. You may remember it took 9 hours, 25 minutes. We follow Darth Bane and his apprentice Xana, but also some new characters, just like in the previous two parts. This time I found these new characters actually interesting in their own right. So this is an improvement compared to parts 1 and 2. The action scenes are fantastic, read perfectly thrillingly by Davis and enhanced even more by tracks from John Williams' original soundtrack. The plot kept me interested in between action scenes as well, although it did ask me to suspend a lot of my disbelief in terms of consistency of character and skill set. I can't say more, otherwise I'd spoil it. The sound effects were awesome as always, with one minor criticism. At one point, the alarms are going off for a long time. It got on my nerve a bit, since you can't tone it down without losing the narration. The final confrontation had me at the edge of my seat. The action climbed and climbed and climbed to a climax, which when it finally arrived, however, left me wondering, wait, what happened? So not entirely as satisfying as I'd hoped, especially after such a thrilling ride to the top. The epilogue is a definite cliffhanger, leaving me again dangling in the void of wanting more. But this time there's no more sequels to quench that thirst. Not so cool. But those are only minor peeves and not worth subtracting any stars. All in all, this trilogy was absolutely thrilling, exciting, and totally awesome. Jonathan Davis is a fantastic narrator with a huge range of voices without overacting. This third part of the series made me want to listen to Darth Plagueis again, even though I finished that not too long ago, because it is the next novel in the long, long list of the Star Wars Expanded Universe novels, and this trilogy left me really wanting some sort of continuity fix. So, as you may have guessed already, 5 stars for performance, 5 stars for the story, and so 5 stars overall. So again, thank you for listening, stay geeky, and tot de volgende keer! Bye-bye!
Ah, it's finally here. It took years and cost me a fortune to track down this collection of the rarest sequential art collections in the world.
They're just comics, Dad. You got them from the very back of the clearance bin at the comic shop.
Just help me get the lid off.
I am the genie of the long box. I shall grant you 3 wishes.
I wish I could read comics in a modern form that lets me take as many as I wanted anywhere I want.
It is done. Henceforth, comics shall descend from the cloud directly into your mobile device.
I wish publishers would give away free books to promote the growth of the art form.
It is done. Henceforth, the first Saturday in May shall be known as Free Comic Book Day.
I wish someone who really loved comics would do a podcast and article series about them.
Very well. Then I shall take you into the long box.
I never would have guessed that Sonic the Hedgehog and Archie Comics would be the ones to revitalize my interest in superhero comics. For reasons I won't go into immediately, I walked away from both Marvel and DC in 2009-2010. They simply stopped telling the kinds of superhero stories I wanted. When Humble Bundle featured a selection of Sonic the Hedgehog comics as their digital book bundle, I thought it was a good opportunity to stoke my son's interest in reading in general, and comics in particular. I read the first book just to see what Sonic looked like these days. It hooked me instantly. I remember when Sonic the Hedgehog premiered in Archie Comics back in 1993. I considered it a kid's book with goofy artwork and the kind of 4-page gags for which Archie Comics was known. The new Sonic book I read was from 2013. It began with Sonic and Tails fighting for their lives against a tentacular mechanized horror controlled by a sinister and murderous stuffed doll. The book slowly introduced me to the principal cast, only a few of whom I knew from the cartoons and video games. It hinted at a history of loss and sacrifice, implying that Sonic and the Freedom Fighters were all that stood between the Eggman army and total subjugation of the world. I never really considered Eggman a villain to be taken seriously, knowing him only from the video game character model and the goofy dialogue of the cartoons. The comic introduced me to a man consumed by selfishness and his own ego, commanding minions that were obviously terrified of him. Still, it wasn't until Eggman defeated a gun carrier fleet all by himself that I began to consider him a threatening antagonist. He clearly had his eye on the big picture, with the resources and ability to follow through on his threats. I still didn't like the character model, but it had improved significantly since the 1990s. As I read, Sonic laid out the bones of what had come before and introduced me to the current status quo. Turns out I was coming in on the heels of a continuity restructuring. It was convenient for me, as I knew nothing of the previous stories. Prior to the reboot, Sonic's Freedom Fighters had suffered devastating losses. Antoine de Coulette was in a coma. Antoine's wife, Bunny, had lost her cybernetic powers and run away. Sonic's love interest, Princess Sally Acorn, had been transformed into a murderous, roboticized slave of the Eggman Empire. Currently, the fighters were scattered across the face of the planet, conveniently allowing Sonic and Tails to reintroduce them one at a time. Piece by piece, the gang came back together, events from the previous continuity washed away by the reboot and remembered only by the core cast and only as a fading dream. Now healthy, Antoine looks back on his injury with a shudder of relief at a tragedy narrowly averted. Bunny's cybernetics are back, and she mourns the loss of a normal life with her husband while renewing her determination to fight Eggman. When Sonic finally discovers that Sally is no longer roboticized and is preparing to return safely from a secret mission, I let out a breath I didn't realize I was holding. And then Eggman finds out. See, Eggman remembers the previous world as well, a world in which he was considered something of a joke. While in this one, he is feared by allies and enemies alike. In the previous world, he worked on gimmicky schemes with dwindling resources. In the new one, he commands a global empire and significant military might. None of this means anything to him, because in the world that was, Sonic suffered the loss of friends and family. When he discovers that Sally is no longer a robot slave, the until now coldly calculating Eggman throws a tantrum and acts with pure, petty vindictiveness. "Send Metal Sonic," he orders. "Sonic never sees her again. Alive." I swear this used to be a kid's book. I had two titles and 3 years' worth of issues in each one to catch up on. I read through them all in a week. Rather than the silliness I associated with the Sonic cartoons, I discovered a complex world where a small band of extraordinary individuals stood against extraordinary threats. The villains acted with viciousness and desperation. The heroes stood ready to sacrifice everything. The fallout of their battles left ragged lives in its wake, even when things worked out mostly for the best. Hero and villain alike struggled with the moral, emotional, and philosophical consequences of their actions. The action was relentless. The violence was usually subtle and occasionally shocking, but my youngest nephew could read this without my very protective sister batting an eye. From this point on, every superhero book I ever read will be held to a standard set by the adventures of an anthropomorphic hedgehog and his egg-shaped nemesis. Archie's stable of artists draw the book with clarity and emotion, staying consistently on model. The color palettes tend to show their video game origins with bright, vibrant hues that pop off the page for most of the action, but turn subdued when things trend toward the serious. The lettering is a bit larger than I'm used to, but it makes the books considerably easier to read in digital or digest formats. I'd never heard of writer Ian Flynn before reading Sonic the Hedgehog. He took over the Sonic titles in 2006 and also worked on several other books for Archie, including The New Crusaders. He also wrote every issue of Archie's Mega Man series, which I'm now determined to hunt down, and not only for the two epic crossovers with Sonic. I used to think this was just a kid's book, but it has rapidly become my superhero title of choice, surpassing even Grant Morrison's luminary work on JLA in the 2000s. I regret not having discovered it sooner. Archie Comics has made every issue of both Sonic and Mega Man available digitally through their own app and through Comixology. They also publish their older works in digest collections and the new works in trade paperback. The Sonic titles are currently on hiatus while Archie Comics and Sega talk through some licensing issues, but you can bet I'll be there to pick up the next issue when things finally resolve. In the meantime, Archie has most of the trades on sale through their website and special deals going through their digital outlets. It's a great opportunity to catch up on the stories, starting with a trade paperback Countdown to Chaos, or issue 252. If you are a fan of superhero comics, action-adventure stories, or simply have the ability to read, you need to be reading Sonic the Hedgehog. I give the two Sonic books, Sonic the Hedgehog and Sonic Universe, quality scores of superior and relevance scores of high. And don't forget to check out the written version of the article on the Christian Geek Central blog, complete with examples of artwork from the comics.
Scanning for Christian Geeks. Subject located, verifying status. Christian Geek status verified. Begin data transmission.
Your Christian Geek Radar covering the month of, what would it be?
June? June, yeah, June 2017. I actually don't have anything in the way of, like, news updates to report in the world of Christian geekery, but I still wanted to highlight some stuff, and I picked the theme of Christian sci-fi stories and worlds. And so I've got some novelists to share with you, and also a couple, at least one or two video games to share with you. The first is John Del Arroz, who writes steampunk and science fiction, and you can find him over at Del Arroz, DelArroz.com, where you can find the books he's written, including for Steam and Country and Star Realms, which is part of, I think, the fictional universe of a deck building game. Yeah. Anyway, and he's got a nice sense of humor on his site. Under testimonials, it says testimonials on how author John Del Arroz has changed the lives of others through his writings. And then he's got quotes like delusional, says Bane author Sharon Lee, boorish, says Babylon 5 writer and creator J. Michael Straczynski. Reading comprehension saves lives, but your lack thereof gets you my mute button, says author Catherine Locke. If you want drinking before thinking, he's your man, says author and storyteller M. Todd Galloglass. Galloglass? I don't know how you say that. And egregiously stupid, says SFWA president Kat Rambo. But if you go over to the page on Amazon.com for his book For Steam and Country, you can get a nice description and also some much more flattering testimonials. Let me read the description for the book For Steam and Country. It says, her father's been pronounced dead. Destructive earthquakes ravage the countryside. An invading army looms over the horizon. And Zyra's day is just getting started. I'm saying Zyra, by the way, because it's Z-A-I-R-A, and I don't know, it could be Zaira. But I'm going to say Zyra, because that's what I'm going to say. Abandoned at an early age, Zyra von Monocle, which is a great name, found life as the daughter of a great adventurer to be filled with hard work and difficulty. She quickly learned to rely on only herself. But when a messenger brought news that her father was dead and that she was the heir to his airship, her world turned upside down. Zyra soon finds herself trapped in the midst of a war between her home country of Rizlandia and the cruel Wyrenth Empire, whose soldiers are acting peculiarly almost inhuman. With the enemy army advancing, her newfound ship's crew may be the only ones who can save the kingdom. For Steam and Country is the first book in the Adventures of Baron von Monocle series by top 10 Amazon best-selling space opera author John Del Arroz. Witty, charming, and downright thrilling, Del Arroz nails the feel of good old-fashioned steampunkery with wit, aplomb, and of course panache, says Nick Cole, author of the Dragon Award winner Control-Alt-Revolt. And For Steam and Country is a rousing, girl-powered fantasy tale. I thoroughly enjoyed this action-packed airship adventure, says Laurie Forrest, author of The Black Witch. So anyway, you can get more about John Del Arroz by visiting his site at DelArroz.com. Let's see here, and moving on. Oh, before I move on, though, I want to thank Adam Collings and his YouTube channel, which features the show Science Christian Science Fiction and Fantasy Bulletin, which he puts out every month and is always very useful to me when I'm putting together the Christian Geek Radar. Next up is Kathy Tyers, which I think that's how you say her name. I don't know. I should know by now. She's been around forever. She was like the first Christian science fiction author I had ever heard of. When I ran into one of her books in a Christian bookstore way back in college, this would be like late 90s, early 2000s. I was like, oh my gosh, someone is doing Christian sci-fi and it's not about the end times. let's see here. The brief little bio. There's a full-length bio on her site, which I found out she actually comes from Montana, which is where I come from as well. But anyway, it says Kathy Tyers is the author of the Firebird series, Firebird, Fusion Fire, Crown of Fire, Wind and Shadow, and Daystar, of the standalone science fiction novels Shivering World, Crystal Witness, and One Mind's Eye, and the Star Wars universe novels Truce at Bakura and New Jedi Order Balance Point. I remember a person in college, I'm almost sure this really happened, I'm not positive, that said to me that they've got this friend that she has written a Star Wars novel.
And I said, oh, really? What star is it? And they said, Trusa Bakura. And I was like, I don't know, sounds boring, you know? And he's like, no, it's really good, you know? And I've this, I mean, it was more of an acquaintance than a friend. I since can't remember who the friend was, and I've totally lost touch with him, of course, anyway. But now I wish I could go back in time and ask more questions, dang it. Because they said specifically that this person was a Christian. But anyway. So yeah, there's just a bunch. You can find her Firebird trilogy, which Enclave Publishing is now republishing in new editions. And let me read you the synopsis here of the first book in the Firebird trilogy. It says on the little promotional thing here, Enclave Publishing has re-released Firebird, making this the first book of the award-winning Firebird series available as a single volume for the first time since 1999. New editions of all five... Oh, it's not a trilogy, dummy. Sorry, guys. New editions of all five Firebird series novels are planned. Lady Firebird, it says in the description, was born to the royal family of Nataya, but her life is expendable. Honorable suicide is the highest calling she could hope to attain. When she is chosen to lead an attack on the neighboring non-combatant planet of Vero, dang it, all these like fictional places and people. When she's chosen to lead an attack on the neighboring non-combatant planet of Vero, her death is expected. Instead, she's taken prisoner during the battle and is held by the enemy. With her own people seeking her sacrifice, Firebird must choose between two worlds before she can carve out her new destiny. This is the story of Lady Firebird's personal battle and its eternal consequences, not only for herself, but for everyone around her, and especially the man who loves her. So you can get more on Kathy Tyers and her books by going to Kathy Tyers, K-A-T-H-Y, and then her last name is spelled T-Y-E-R-S.com. Let's see here. And then the last author that I'm going to focus on is Timothy C. Ward. I've mentioned one of his book releases on this segment, or do you call it a segment if it's on YouTube? On the podcast, it's a segment. On YouTube, it's a thing. What do I call it? Show? I don't know what to call this. On the Christian Greek is a Greek radar. Crap! Geez, I'm not editing. I got other stuff I got to do and get done today. Okay, so Timothy C. Ward. And specifically, I'm going to highlight, since last time I think I highlighted God's Knife Revolt, this time I'm going to zoom in a little bit on his book, Scavenger Evolution. And the description reads, some treasure hunters will never learn. In an effort to save his wife, sand diver Rush Stenson is blackmailed into uncovering a lost city and the power behind the apocalypse. If he doesn't lock it back up, the wrong hands will use it to enslave what's left of humanity. Inspired by the world created by Hugh Howey in his novel Sand, written and sold with his permission, the Sand Divers books are a standalone duology loved by fans for its breakneck pace and under sand knife fight, great special effects, and endearing characters that kept me wanting for more, unquote. I said unquote, but I didn't say quote at the beginning, so hopefully you're keeping pace. Sorry, guys. This cyberpunk post-apocalyptic thriller is an ideal fit for fans of Blake Crouch, Nicholas Sansbury Smith, DJ Moles, Nick Cole, and Edward W. Robertson. Robertson. Dang it. I know I mispronounced, I don't know, I probably mispronounced a couple of those names. I try to just say them with confidence so that you don't know, like when you're reading like really old Bible names in places. But that last one I stumbled on, sorry about that, guys. Anyway, so yeah, this is cyberpunk post-apocalyptic thriller, which is, you know, I really wanted to focus on science fiction type settings this time because I feel like they're a lot less common than fantasy settings in Christian fiction. I don't know if that's because fantasy lends itself, I think, a little bit more to the metaphorical and spiritual themes. I think it does. That's been my experience with fantasy. And sci-fi tends to be more cerebral and very often dominated by naturalistic worldviews. So I don't know if there's a connection there, but anyway, I really wanted to try and focus on science fiction this time around. The last thing I want to focus on is in the realm of science fiction, but it's a video game instead of a book. And that's Soma Games. If you go to somagames.com, you'll find three games, two that are still in development, which are Wind Up Robots and Redwall, which, yes, is based on the beloved Redwall books. I assume they're beloved because I've heard people talk about them and really hold them in high esteem, and the website says that they're beloved, so there you go.
But the video game that has been released and is actually available both on Steam and Xbox One is G Prime, which is described as the first chapter in Soma Games' Arc Saga, and is a gorgeously rendered take on the classic gravity golf genre of puzzle games, while adding unprecedented depth of story and adventure elements. So basically, from what I can gather in this game, you are kind of controlling a ship in space that is doing certain things that I'm sure the story will explain, and one reviewer that I checked out about this game just said he was surprised and delighted at the amount of story and world building and all the kind of the depth of the fiction of this world, despite the fact that it's, you know, kind of just a physics puzzle game. You are kind of controlling the ship and then shooting off these rockets that are supposed to go on a specific course, and so you are determining settings like thruster speed, the length that you're burning the thruster, and you're factoring in the gravity of nearby bodies in space, you know, as you're trying to get this rocket to go where it's supposed to go. And it's got kind of a neat kind of retro sci-fi interface where you're getting your missions from like this like old school threaded printer, you know, and it almost has, I want to say, like a steampunk vibe to it when you're in the cockpit of the ship and kind of controlling, getting ready to take on the next mission, finding out the information that you need to in order to succeed in the mission. And so anyway, it looks really cool. And like I said, you can get that on Steam or Xbox One. Soma Games is an interesting little game studio. Let me see that they're where do we go here? Okay, yeah, they talked about. I mean, they are Christians making games from a Christian perspective, but I really find interesting, and I think it's actually great what they write in their up on their about page. They have two paragraphs. One that says what's with quote unquote Soma, and they explain, you know, what that means and where it comes from. And of more interest to me is what they say under the heading "What Soma Games Is Not." And that paragraph reads, while Soma Games is a group of Christians making video games, we're not what you might call a quote-unquote Christian video game company. And it's important for us to be very clear about this to avoid inaccurate expectations. We're making games that will be founded upon and informed by Christian thought and the Christian understanding of reality. However, we don't plan on making games that teach Christian theology. There are no scripture references, no biblical characters, and no telling of the Jonah story. Other companies have been there and done a fine job. We hope to try something a little different. And I think that's great to be breaking from the mold and always thinking about the different ways that we as Christians can enter into the creative space as we think about who our audience will be, how we want to communicate ideas to that audience, how much and how little we want to say, you know, about the gospel and about other biblical truths, and in what ways, what unique ways we can be a light and represent Christ in a certain setting and to a certain audience. So I really appreciate them just taking a unique approach and being very upfront about that as well. So anyway, hopefully they'll find tons of great success. And again, the name of that game is G Prime. You can find more information by going to somagames.com.
Well, thank you all for joining me on this historic day. The serum I've created will give anyone who drinks it the power to objectively know the difference between something that is cool and something that is lame. The serum is available to anyone who provides a review for the Spirit Blade Underground podcast and is completely safe. Allow me to demonstrate.
War for the Planet of the Apes. The synopsis provided by 20th Century Fox on IMDb reads, Caesar and his apes are forced into a deadly conflict with an army of humans led by a ruthless colonel. After the apes suffer unimaginable losses, Caesar wrestles with his darker instincts and begins his own mythic quest to avenge his kind. As the journey finally brings them face to face, Caesar and the colonel are pitted against each other in an epic battle that will determine the fate of both their species and the future of the planet. All right, so first, as we have someone blowing leaves outside, I apologize for that. Let me talk about my biases. This is the Blood Ape monster card for Descent First Edition. Actually, it's the Road to Legend expansion version of that card. And these are the miniatures for it. These have been completely removed from my edition of Descent. I've taken them
out of every game session that I've played because I hate them. Why? Because I don't like anthropomorphic animals. I don't like animal. I think apes are among the silliest. I think all of them are silly, and I think apes are among the silliest. I ran a DC Heroes paper and pencil RPG for years, and I never included Gorilla Grodd or Ultra Humanite because I don't find them threatening. I find them silly. I think the closest I came to finding... this is a little bit of popcorn left there. Speaking of kernels. And the Gorilla Grodd story that came closest to making him threatening to me was written by Jeff Johns, and it just worked on a one-shot issue, and after that I was like, okay, well, you barely got it to work this time, but I hate anthropomorphic... Okay, and right on cue, he's blowing right outside of my window. I hate anthropomorphic animals. I think that they're silly, and that anthropomorphic apes and monkeys are among the silliest. I am not the audience for this movie or this film series. I don't think there's anything wrong with you if you don't find anthropomorphic animals silly, but I do, and so I am not the audience for this movie. They're going for a serious tone, which I appreciate. I tend to like more serious toned fiction. It's got action, but it's far from action-packed. It's got lots of drama and quiet character scenes, which would normally be like a great thing for me, but it's almost all with CG apes. I mean, a ton of this movie. The first hour is almost exclusively CG apes. At times, it almost seemed to be, and in my notes, I put aping, and yes, that is the word that came to mind. It seemed to be kind of like aping drama movie cliches about solidarity, but with apes. You know, like that moment in a movie where, like, someone gives a stirring speech to a crowd that's opposed to them, but then one person stands and does the slow clap, and then you know what happens after that. Everybody joins in, you know. Or, you know, in one scene, these apes are kind of separated from each other, and they're in separate cages, and one of them kind of does a brave act, you know, and the others slowly show their solidarity by lifting up the ape symbol with their fists, you know, of apes strong together. Little things like that all over the place, both in terms of solidarity-type stories, and also stories that just have to do with human drama and loss. It's weird. It's like... It's like seeing all these key moments in tons of movies that I've seen in the past, but with this little novelty that, hey, it's this, but with apes. So, I had trouble, I think, feeling what they were intending for me to feel. It borrows its core antagonist, played by Woody Harrelson, from Apocalypse Now. And he's, you know, this rogue military leader who's off in the middle of nowhere, and his soldiers revere him like a god, you know, and there's even, like, graffiti that's found in one of the sewers that says Apocalypse Now. And it makes sense in the context of the story why they would say that, but still, it was a little too close to the... a little too on the nose in terms of where they took their inspiration for the villain. It's 2 hours and 20 minutes long. When I saw the runtime, I was like, oh, do I really want to review this? 2 hours and 20 minutes of mostly CG ape drama. So if you feel like that you'll have a better chance of connecting with that, which I hope you will, then maybe it'll be worth watching to you at least at some point. I could not connect with CG ape drama, and so I couldn't connect with the story or the characters. But again, that's probably fairly specific to my personal condition, whatever you want to call it. As far as the cast and the performances involved in the movie, I mean, most of them were CG. Woody Harrelson, I think, did a fine job. He's been the bad guy before. He does it well again here, but not in a way that stands out to me at all compared to his past roles. I do want to talk about where I would normally talk about stunts and visuals. I mean, stunts are fine, you know, they're mostly CG. There's some explosions and stuff, but I want to talk about the visuals. I have, as I've mentioned in many of my reviews in the past, so I apologize for those who've heard this a million times, I have an eye that seems to be cursed to pick out CG, and it takes me out of the movie, particularly CG when it's recreating biological creatures. And the more human-like they are, the more personality traits they have of humans, the more anthropomorphic they are, whatever, the harder it is for me to kind of get invested, you know, in the reality of the scene instead of thinking about actors looking at ping pong balls. These apes looked great. I said that about the last movie too, and they may have even gotten better. I'm not sure. I haven't seen the last movie since the one and only time I saw it. And this, the apes, I think, are better if possible. And I almost want to say that the apes were practical effects, like maybe people in costumes except for the heads, and then they just inserted CG animation, you know, for the faces and stuff. But I would be willing to believe, maybe, just based on the pedigree of the effects in the past two films in this series, that
these apes are completely CG. I have trouble believing that because, like, my eyes are completely fooled by the fur and a lot of the body movements, you know, of the apes. I'm like, that looks like it could be a dude in a suit and you just put CG to make his face move, you know. It looked great. It really looked great. Apart from, I would say, lip movement, fine facial muscle movement, and acrobatic stuff. Whenever they're really jumping around and stuff like that, it's just a little too, it kind of has that kind of CG fluidity to it. And so really, as I've said before, I think the forward motion that needs to happen to really fool my eyes in the world of CG is not about texture quality so much as it is about specificity of motion capture and being able to get those fine details captured. And I think they're getting closer and closer. And that's one thing that I feel like I've been able to count on with this series and probably going forward if they continue it, that it's just going to continue raising the bar or at least representing the top, you know, quality that's currently available in terms of creature creation being realistic looking to my eyes. So I'm wondering after I see this one, I mean, okay, have we finally mastered at least some limited degree of motion capture? Because like I said, I would be willing to believe that like a lot of these apes, when they were doing close-ups and in kind of like the quieter scenes, were not CG, that they were like costumes and then they CG'd the faces or whatever. Anyway, I want this to be the new standard for all animal/alien CG creatures in future movies. I think they did a great job. Okay, so I always try to ask myself, is there anything of worthwhile, spiritual, moral, or philosophical significance going on in the themes of this that might spark worthwhile thought or conversation? And maybe, I think I got a little splinter. Ow, dang it. Maybe it probably depends on if you're kind of looking for it. I'm always kind of looking for it, you know, in preparation for these reviews. So anyway, the assumption of the first film is that apes can become like humans. In other words, specifically being introspective and having a clear moral compass and a sense of self-worth would be, I guess, the three things that first come to mind. So the assumption of the first film and the ones that follow is that apes can become like humans simply by increasing the functionality of their brains, of their physical biological matter. But this assumes that those unique qualities of the human mind can be reduced to merely physical processes of the brain, which science hasn't proven, and I disagree with. Correlation is not the same as cause and effect. It's actually an assumption that reveals a naturalistic worldview, which would also hold, as it happens, that humans have no more objective and intrinsic worth than, say, apes, dogs, slugs, or weeds. So on that level, I've always struggled to feel what these movies want me to feel because I can't seem to set aside my problems with the assumptions contained in the premise of the series. I don't say that to say, like, you know, if you're a real Christian, you know, you won't be able to set those things aside. You'll just be committed to it. No. I mean, I'm able to set aside, you know, other, you know, philosophical issues that I have in other stories and stuff like that and still kind of enter in and try to, you know, connect with the fiction that's being presented to me. For some reason, that's an element that I have trouble shaking when it comes to movies like this or movies about AI that we're supposed to really love and, you know, feel feelings about, you know. So anyways, that's something that's kind of on me, but I do think that it's there. I do think that it's kind of implied in the premise of the movie. This movie continues upholding a naturalistic vibe, I think, by downplaying the worth of humans. There's really only one human that I remember in this movie that's good, and it's a child. It's a mute child, kind of an innocent. And there are no other humans that I remember that are like, you know, really good humans. And it's clear that at the end of the movie that humans are kind of on their way out as a species. And this isn't treated as a tragic thing, you know. The movie's also building up the worth of apes through the display of numerous personality traits that almost exclusively represent the best of human potential. I felt like in the last movie, they had a little bit more balance. They had like crazy, nasty apes and stuff. And there are still some of those in this movie, but I don't want to spoil anything, but, you know, I don't feel like the negative traits of humanity were near as much represented in the apes in this movie as they were in the last movie. The negative traits of humanity were kind of what humans were all about. The positive traits of humanity were kind of what, like, the apes were all about, with some rare and, I would say, subtle exceptions. The apes also conduct a sort of funeral at the beginning, near the beginning of this movie, that seems to have spiritual overtones. You know, rather than simply burying the bodies of they're dead. They uniformly, you can, it looks even from a distance, they're uniformly wrapped, carefully wrapped in cloth, and then sent floating down a river. Does this imply that, you know, is this being implied by the writers, the filmmakers, that spiritual beliefs are nothing more than a product of naturalistic evolution? I'm not going to go that far and say that that's kind of a message they're trying to put out there or assumption, but I did think it was interesting. There seemed to also be a subtly liberal political vibe going on when comparing the humans and the apes. Now, I usually am not interested in kind of getting into pulling out political themes in this one, but it did pop out to me a little bit because one of the ways in which they kind of deal with this kind of like what seems to be kind of a political representation of a political divide between liberals and conservatives was that religion was a major component in one of those two sides. So that's why I'm talking about, you know, kind of like political themes. Don't count on that really in the future. Mostly I stick to purely moral and philosophical and spiritual themes. There is some overlap, I get that, but anyway, blah, blah, blah. So what did I see that kind of indicated maybe there's some subtle you know, commentary in favor of liberal thinking going on in this movie? Well, the corporal leading this rogue military force, the bad guy leading the bad guys, has his men chant that they are the beginning and the end. And they use the Greek letters Alpha and Omega as a self-identifying symbol. And this echoes what God says of himself being the Alpha and the Omega in Revelation 1:8, 21:6, and 22:13. His men also greatly revere him, and the corporal also reveals that he sacrificed his only son. Well, he said sacrifice my only son to save the world. Sacrifice my only son to save the world. So there's some kind of God complex definitely going on. At the very least, it's a weird religious extremism, which is often popularly, at least, associated with the political right. The corporal criticizes Caesar at least twice for being so emotional, he says, rather than thinking clearly about things. And the political right is sometimes accused of being cold, while the left, as we've heard the expression, is often said to have, quote, unquote, bleeding hearts. The rogue military force is armed to the teeth, you know, guns, 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 due to their strategic location. And during a scene in which they abuse enslaved apes, the United States national anthem is blaring over the loudspeakers on the base. So, like, guns, guns, you know, it's like crazy God beliefs and guns and country, you know, which is often, you know, kind of associated with the right, popularly speaking. By contrast, the apes desire and promote peace. They use very few guns, and they have a live and let live approach to relations with humans. And the apes themselves, in their mistreatment, I think may appeal to those with a great compassion for animal rights. Again, that's a characteristic that we tend to associate with the left. Now, ironically on that point, I would actually feel more compassion for the animals in this story if they were real, natural animals. Our responsibility as stewards of God's creation, made in his image and given capacity for both reason and moral judgment, is to care for and safeguard the world and its creatures. So I would actually feel more compassion for their mistreatment if they were quote-unquote dumb animals rather than kind of being given these human qualities. But despite these little thematic Easter eggs being all over the place, I don't know. They don't stand out strong enough to me to feel very purposeful. I could easily believe that they're just in the story almost unintentionally because that's kind of the popular paradigm and way of thinking about what is good and what is bad. So it could be like almost unconscious on the part of the writers. I don't know. It doesn't seem like really preachy. It's just like, huh, okay. So what would I say at the end of the day? Well, I have no idea what your preferences are, but if I had a time machine, I'd go back in time and say, Pater, skip it. Skip this movie. Come on. You know you're not the audience for this movie. Wait for the potential soft reboot of the series that could possibly happen in the future. Maybe it'll jump ahead like 500 years and you'll get something that you'll like better. You are not the audience for this movie, so just stay away. It's rated PG-13 for sequences of sci-fi violence and action, thematic elements, and some disturbing images. Feedback. Give me your thoughts on this podcast, Christian Geek Central, the YouTube channel, or anything else we're doing. What should we keep? What should we change? Or what's on your mind you'd like a potentially uninformed opinion on? We want to make this show and all of Christian Geek Central as fun, as useful as we can, but I've got to hear from you to do that. You can send an email or audio file recorded on your phone to paeter@spiritblade.com. All right, let me just briefly pray in light of some of the prayer requests that have been up on the forums at ChristianGeekCentral.com lately. Lord Jesus, we ask that you would just
reveal your compassion to us in the context of just our sickness and our bodies failing on us and the effect that that has on our work life, on our home lives. We just can be so easily discouraged by sickness and the insecurity as well that that can sometimes bring about, and the stress and all the other things that come about just from our bodies not yet being the resurrected, glorified bodies that you have promised to us. So we pray that you will remind us of the hope that we have in those bodies, and then also give us comfort and assurance of your presence and your movement and working and your activity in our lives, even through our sickness right now. We also thank you for opportunities that we have to represent you to others in maybe a larger way than we normally have day to day. As those opportunities come up, we pray that we would enter into them with humility, and that you would equip us to equip others and to just be a blessing to others, whether we're able to share our faith immediately in the context or not. We pray that we would always have a mind for serving others, being useful to others, and just giving others a good experience with one of your people. And so we pray that you'd empower us and prepare us for those kinds of things. And we thank you for those opportunities as they come up. In your name we pray. Amen. Well, I want to thank Winston Crutchfield and Katja from the Netherlands for the segments that they sent in. Awesome stuff. Once again, guys, thank you so much for that. And I want to take just a minute and thank those of you who sent me messages to send along to Holly, just by to give her a thank you and a word of encouragement, maybe, for just the work that she's been doing behind the scenes to both feed me and my boys and herself, our family. And also ensure that I can continue giving my time to Spirit Blade Productions and all that that involves. That's only possible because of my wife's tireless efforts in a job that really gives her no fulfillment over the last 10-plus years. So I shared all those with her, and also some of the ones that came a little bit late, but the bulk of them I shared with her when we went out, just the two of us, for dessert while we were on vacation. And there were tears, and there was laughing, and it was just a moving time, and it was a real blessing to her, and it was a blessing to me that you guys brought that about. So thank you very much for that. And I don't want to put a cap on that. You know, if you wanted to do that, or suddenly you're just hearing about this now and you'd like to do that, really anytime, guys, you want, you're more than welcome to send me a message that I can send along to Holly to encourage her. But I did want to take just a moment and thank all of you guys, those of you who got stuff in by the deadline, and the stuff that came in. There's two or three that came a little bit later, and those were likewise moving and encouraging to Holly. So thank you very, very much for being a part of that. Stay tuned for DS9 Shawarma after the credits, or jump back to episode 400 if you want to start from the beginning. Next week, if God allows it, I'll be sharing info on some more free video games for you as we continue celebrating the Summer of Free. I'm also planning to review Valerian, City of a Thousand Planets, whatever the crap that means. I think it's based on a comic book and directed by the same guy who did Mila Jovovich, Bruce Willis, Fifth Element, I think. Man, I'm not so good with numbers. Anyway, I had mixed feelings about that one. It's one that's in my collection, and I'm interested to see what he's going to do with this, but I wonder if it's going to be cool and imaginative, or just kind of like, boy, this is kind of weird and French. Is that racist? I'm probably racist. I don't know. Anyway, and In Search of Truth will also be making its return to this podcast. We've had a break from that for a little while, but I've been looking forward to getting back into that with you guys. So till then, check out spiritblade.com and Christian Geek Central for more stuff made just for you guys. Thank you so much for making time for this show. I hope you all have a great week, and that you're experiencing God's blessing. You're aware of his movement in your life, and the compassion, the patience, the grace that he has for you. I hope that you experience all of that this week, and also that you'll join me next time here on the Spirit Blade Underground podcast as we continue to geek out and seek the truth.
The Spirit Blade Underground is a community-supported endeavor of Spirit Blade Productions. This podcast is produced by Peter Frampson with support from the Christian Geek Central community at ChristianGeekCentral.com. For information about the latest entertainment and resources from Spirit Blade Productions, visit SpiritBlade.com. Thank you for listening.
wormhole.
The Dominion has endured for 2,000 years and will continue to endure long after the Federation has crumbled into dust.
No!
5 years ago, no one had ever heard of Bajor or Deep Space Nine, and now all our hopes rest here.
And that was Explorers, the story of three young boys who managed to make a magic bubble and fly in this... No, wait, no. That's a different thing called Explorers. This is a Deep Space Nine episode, and we're coming off that awesome two-parter which turned the story, had a Dominion giant fleet fight and all that, and this is a small story. They come down and we catch our breath, and it's just pure character stuff, nothing important.
Yeah, we just stop for a little bit of character fluff.
Yes. Sisko comes back, and the only thing that has any meaning to any continuity in this episode is Sisko has a beard now. And that's how important this episode is Sisko has facial hair. But he comes back, and he's got the plans for the Bajorans in, 800 years before, they were building solar sailors and going around the star system, and there were even rumors that they had managed to make their way all the way to Cardassia somehow, which was, years away at sublight, lower than warp speed. So Sisko decides he's going to build the ship himself, authentic history. It's basically, was it Kon-Tiki?
Yeah, it's essentially Kon-Tiki in space, which, if you don't know, is the story of a sailor slash historian who wanted to prove that it was possible to essentially cross the South Pacific in an authentic Polynesian raft, which he built, and he spent, 30-something days at sea, and he proved that it was, in fact, possible with the technology of the time, which is what Sisko's trying to do. He's trying to build this thing exactly as the ancient Bajorans would have built it as much as possible to show whether or not the trip was feasible.
So, yeah, not exactly like critical or important. It's his hobby, he says so himself. And, of course, he brings Jake along. That's one of the main things he wants this for, is from father-son time. And, it's interesting. Jake's talking about he wants to be a writer, and he's going to go to this school. It's a typical father-son stuff. It's not bad. It's just, nothing too special. But, again, it's a nice come-down after the intensity of the last two-parter. I will say, when I caught this episode when it first aired, this was the episode, seeing what Sisko is a really good dad, and the kind of time he dedicates to his son, when people like Kirk and Picard couldn't even bring it to themselves to ever get married and have kids, and the kids they had, they really were absentee fathers to, and seeing Sisko be a good dad. That's what really made me, that first thing that made me say, you know what, Sisko's an awesome captain, he might be my new favorite.
Well, and not just spending time with Jake, but encouraging Jake's personal aspirations, even the ones he doesn't share, giving him good, sound advice, not just to the tune of, here's what you need to do.
Yeah, but, none of this follow your heart crap.
Yeah, here's the experience that I had, when I broke away from my dad and my family to do what was in my heart. So, take that and learn from that, basically.
I suppose there is one more bit of continuity. We're introduced to Lita in this episode. Lita is a Dabo girl who's basically a cocktail waitress, if you will. It's more involved, but it's basically that in Quark's bar. And she will be a semi-tertiary level character from now on, off and on.
And she's not a bad person, but she's a seriously dim bulb.
Yes.
And her entrance just slaps that right up in your face that she's...
Imagine Jessica Rabbit if Jessica Rabbit was as dumb as she pretends to be in the cartoons.
Yeah, Jessica Rabbit is a Bajoran, basically.
Yeah, and a stupid one.
Yeah.
So, so we get introduced to that in Sisko's facial hair. The subplot is actually, I think, more interesting. And again, it's fluff, but it's good character fluff. Bashir's old, because Bashir was salutatorian, which, if you don't know, means second place in his graduating class. And the valedictorian is coming in, and he and she were neck and neck competition, and we go into the whole thing. And there's two things I like about this episode. First, we get a great bromance scene with O'Brien, and they're out drinking because she walked right by him, and so he's feeling like, you know, he feels snubbed.
Like, yeah, well, he thinks she's better than me, yeah. Does she?
He doesn't have a crush on her or anything, but he's kind of obsessed because this was his main competition in school, and now she's acting like he's nothing.
So he and O'Brien get drunk off their bums.
And they're singing.
And they're bonding.
And they're talking about, you know, the I love you man without saying I love you stuff. And, yeah. You know, it's great fun. It's, you know, we've seen it 1,000 times, but it's, you know, Tool time in space, basically. It's Tim and Al. And then later, well, it's not nearly as funny, but it's interesting because this valedictorian, she is on a starship. And she's even dressed like one of the people from TNG, Next Generation. And
she's not just on a starship. She's on one of the top-of-the-line premier ships that everyone wants to be on.
Yeah. And it basically boils down to, it's like comparing Next Generation and Deep Space Nine. It's as close as we ever get to an in-universe comparison, because they're both talking about their roles. And she's talking about how she got kind of bored because they're just going around mission to mission to mission and nothing really, no consequences. You know, just it's...
She doesn't get to stay in any one place long enough to do any serious research.
And she was talking about how...
samples and go.
She envies him that he gets to work on something long-term. And again, it's a great meta-commentary on the benefits of Deep Space Nine compared to TNG. And, you know... And obviously, if you're hearing this, you know that I'm all about DS9. Well, TNG is not a bad show. I love it plenty. But I think Deep Space Nine, I think, is a much better format. Not necessarily because it's in a station. It's just that the station lends itself to the idea that you have consistent people. Again, we see Leela come in.
It encourages greater use of continuity.
Exactly. And secondary and tertiary level characters and callbacks and, you know, all sorts of stuff. It's the kind of thing that... It's more standard now, but at the time, Deep Space Nine really was one of the first shows to have that level of continuity. In fact, that's what really got me back into the show. Was I saw they were starting to make references to previous episodes, and it's like, you know, Next Generation will only rarely refer to an episode, but this one is like, there's a storyline going through all this, and so this is just like a nice little meta commentary on that. But yeah, the Sisko story, you know, again, nothing too special. It's character stuff. It's enjoyable. You don't need to watch this episode at all.
We learned that apparently in the Roddenberryan future, New Zealand is known not as the home of the Lord of the Rings, but as the home of prisoners and famous writers, sometimes both one and the same.
Thinking of Tom Paris on that one.
Yep.
So that's about it. It's, you know, it's an enjoyable episode. It's a little slow-paced, you know. It's certainly not an action piece in any way. Even the action, like, beats of the ship in distress while they're flying around in space is just like, oh, well, we lost a sail. We'll cut the other one loose and off we go. So, yeah. So I guess we'll see you next time for something that's definitely a step down. We're going to meet Quark and Rom's mom. And it's not going to be a fun introduction. We'll see you then.